Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone, again, live from the Green Space today with a Primary Day Politics special. We'll bring in our next guests in just a minute, but a reminder for those of you just tuning in that a big part of today's show, as we often do on election days, is to open the phones for an informal, unofficial, thoroughly unscientific Brian Lehrer Show exit poll. So listeners, if you are voting today, let us know for whom and why at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And in today's case, it's Democratic primaries for New York State offices. So who are you voting for governor, for lieutenant governor, for state attorney general? And right now, a special appeal for anyone voting in the many contested state Senate primaries that could help to determine if Democrats or Republicans control the Senate next year. If you're voting in one of the state Senate primaries, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. If in many years it's boring to talk about primary elections for a state legislature, not this year. It's our informal, unofficial, thoroughly unscientific Brian Lehrer Show exit poll. With me now, three of Spectrum News New York One's best political reporters who also now host a podcast together called Off Topic on Politics, Grace Rao, their City Hall reporter, Zach Fink, their Albany reporter, and Juan Manuel Benitez, host of Puerto Politica on their Spanish language channel, New York One Noticias. Juan Manuel is also a guest host for me here sometimes. He was on Monday, but since he's here as a guest today, he doesn't get paid. Welcome back, all of you, to WNYC for this free appearance. Hi, guys.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
And I guess you're finally getting the message as newly minted podcast hosts that radio is really where it's at. And it's not enough to be on television. If you really want to be something in the media today, you have to be doing audio.
Exactly.
That is true. That is certainly true.
So welcome to podcasting. Let's talk about the IDC, the eight Democratic state senators who help Republicans keep control of the Senate. They've all got primary challenges. And Zach, the big prize for the anti-IDC progressives is to have the political head of Jeff Klein, right, the IDC leader, to get that, you know, on a concession speech skewer tonight. So the challenger is Alessandra Biaggi there in Riverdale and a little bit of Westchester. Tell me about the contours of that race.
It's a very interesting race. Jeff Klein was not thought to be vulnerable initially, and I go back to January of 2017 when the IDC was actually growing. They were adding members recently, and really the tide has turned so dramatically. But Jeff Klein, I would imagine, would have been the last person you thought would fall in that. You saw some vulnerability in Peralta. You saw certainly in Upper Manhattan with Marisol Alcantara, some of the newer members who might be facing challenges. But now Jeff Klein has 32 BJ, the union, coming out for Alessandra Biaggi, and apparently he's got a real problem. I mean, just from what we've been hearing on the ground, that district coincides a little bit with the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez district. It overlaps a little bit. So you have young voters, people who are hungry for change, and that could really have a bad effect on Jeff Klein's traditional get-out-the-vote operation.
Is Ocasio-Cortez getting involved in this race at all? Did she turn out, Juan Manuel, and campaign for Alessandra Biaggi in that part of those parts of the Bronx? Is really very different parts of the Bronx. If we're talking about Riverdale, and mm-hmm. it goes down to the Ocasio-Cortez part, that's down in Throgs Neck and some other areas.
My understanding is that she did, and I saw a tweet the other day saying that they have almost the same name because they're Alexandria and Alessandra, so they've been campaigning together for that seat. But the important thing, Brian, I think over here with the anti-IDC movement, it's going to be like the same thing with the race for governor. What's largest, biggest today? Either energy from the left, from the progressives, from the people who want to get rid of the IDC senators, or the loyalty to the party, to the system, to Andrew Cuomo, and to people like Jeff Klein, who has a strong relationship with the constituents, with the district for many years. So what's going to be strongest today, we're going to see. But so far, we're seeing like a higher turnout from what we hear in certain polling places, at least mine in Harlem. There's more people going to vote, and that can show that there's some energy from some electorate, part of the electorate, that normally maybe they don't go to vote, but this time around, they want to vote against the incumbents and against the IDC in this case.
And IDC, for those of you who don't know, stands for Independent Democratic Conference, and independent in this case meant that they wound up helping the Republicans retain control of the state Senate, and there's a big backlash to that right now by some people voting in the Democratic primary. And another interesting IDC-involved race, Zach, that you mentioned briefly, is in Upper Manhattan, where the IDC person is Marisol Alcantara. Her challenger is Robert Jackson. They are both progressive Democrats. Alcantara claims, Grace, that Latina empowerment, meaning her own election as the first Latina state senator, was reason enough to make this deal with the Republicans. But in so doing, she thwarted the elevation of another woman of color, Senator Andrea Stewart Cousins, who could have become the first black woman Senate majority leader. That trade makes it look more selfish on Alcantara's part. What do you make of her in particular, with her very progressive grassroots background, Bernie Sanders delegate, and things like that, joining the IDC?
So it's interesting. I covered that race. I spent some time with both Robert Jackson and Marisol Alcantara in their district. And Marisol, the point that she made when defending her decision to team up with the IDC to join them is she says that when she put herself forward to run for this seat, that she got no support from the Democratic Party. She got no institutional support. And she felt, frankly, as she said to me, abandoned, and that a woman, a Latina woman in the state Senate was incredibly important to her, especially given the demographics of her district, and that was part of the reason she felt embraced by the IDC, which obviously was trying to grow at the time. And she defended her decision that way. And another interesting point that applies to all of these former IDC members as they go out and try and hold on to their seats despite challengers is that they have, through their relationship with the IDC and the deal that they made with Republicans, they were able to bring a lot more money back into their districts. And so they've argued that that was also part of the reason that they teamed up, was to deliver more directly investments from the state for their constituents. So that's another factor that may be on people's minds is, you know, did somebody like Marisol Alcantara actually deliver? I think she ballparked it for me at $15 million, she said, in new investments into the district that she got. Robert Jackson, of course, a longtime, very familiar face in that district, a longtime member of the city council. He's out there really hustling. This is the second time that they've met at the polls. He actually challenged her 4 years ago and lost, but came very, very close. And so there's a little bit of a repeat happening here. And of course, the contours of that race have changed so dramatically because now the whole issue with the IDC has broken through, not just in New York, but nationally. There are progressive Democrats across the country who can tell you what the IDC is. It was sort of an incredible moment. Zach and I know talked about sort of the first time we went to a party and sort of somebody who's not in politics talked to us about the IDC.
Right.
And it was this realization that, oh, wow, you know, this has been going on for a while in New York, but now after Trump's election, it's finally breaking through and people in New York and across the country are becoming aware of what happened.
And it's a really interesting race because it has split the Dominican community in Upper Manhattan. It's a really diverse district. It goes from Upper Manhattan, Inwood, Washington Heights, and then many blocks of Harlem, Morningside Heights, the Upper West Side, even to Chelsea. This district covers Madison Square Garden, which is really interesting the way they redistricted that district. And it, for the Dominican community in Upper Manhattan, it's so important because DC has been Dominican since 2011. This was Eric Schneiderman's seat till 2011. Then Adriano Espaillat got the seat, and then he supported Marisol Alcantara 2 years ago. Marisol Alcantara ran for this seat 2 years ago, saying that she was going to be part of the IDC. It's not that she flipped afterwards, because there was no problem with the IDC 2 years ago for many Democrats. It's not like now they are the devil. That didn't happen 2 years ago. So the Dominican community right now is split because they don't know what to do with all this messaging of anti-IDC. And also you have Congressman, now Congressman Espaillat, who is a leader of the Dominican political community in Upper Manhattan. He's staying neutral in the race. And he had to suffer huge attacks from Marisol Alcantara. We don't know what his camp is doing to sway the race in maybe Robert Jackson's favor. And there's also two other Dominican candidates on the ballot, Tomas León and Tirso Piña. Who knows what's going to happen with the Dominican voter that goes to the poll place and says, like, you know, Marisol, I don't want to vote for her because she's IDC, but I will go to with other Dominican candidate instead.
And there's an interesting contrast in that race with the main challenger, Robert Jackson, who's African-American. Back in the 90s, he led the Campaign for Fiscal Equity lawsuit to get mm-hmm. more public school funding for New York City. And Alcantara, as part of the IDC, Zach, walked off the Senate floor this year, as you know, rather than vote for some of that money, because her deal with the Republicans forced her to abstain. What a direct contrast with Jackson, and a damning one for her if people choose to focus on that particular piece.
And just to Juan's point, I mean, how much the climate has changed. I mean, it has really shifted. They used to say in Albany all the time, these individuals don't get elected or thrown out of office based on their votes in Albany. It really was what you delivered for the district. Well, I think in the last year that dramatically shifted. So now it is about their votes in Albany. It is about how progressive they are. And, you know, certainly the CFE lawsuit is something that Cynthia Nixon, really, that was the basis for her candidacy, was that the New York State has been shortchanging. They have to provide for the neediest districts and have failed to do so in some key years, and that back money is owed. You know, Robert Jackson was right at the center of that, and that's where the political winds have shifted right now. And you know, I think, again, you know, for the last several years, when Cuomo governed with the IDC and had their help in shepherding certain pieces of legislation through the state Senate, you know, they did get a lot accomplished. I mean, they did get paid family leave. They did get a $15 minimum wage, albeit it was not acceptable to the progressives because it was done in bunches and it's not fully $15 everywhere. That's fair, but you could also make the argument from the other side, and certainly back then people accepted that argument more readily, that without the IDC, they wouldn't have gotten any of that done. So some of the IDC members, I feel like, feel very abandoned that, hey, we got more done than the Republicans ever would, and now we're getting punished for it.
And one more thing about that particular race before we move on. I live in that district, and she seems to have all the money in that race based on the fact that I've gotten a million glossy flyers for her and very little material for him. Who's throwing so much money into that pot and why? Anybody know? Grace?
I don't know.
Jeff Klein has access to a lot of money. He raises a lot of money. He's a prolific fundraiser. He always has been.
Still, the head of the IDC, Jeff Klein money is going into Marisol Alcantara's
pocket.
Yeah,
they have a campaign
today.
Account. It's a little controversial because there was some issue in Albany where the Election Enforcement Commission ruled that they couldn't use it because it was technically owned or controlled by the Independence Party. However, it's unclear that that ruling had any teeth, so they've still been able to. It's been going back and forth whether or not they have access to it. The bottom line is he's been able to use those funds to help out his members.
And one other point, at least one national group that I've done a story about that just does letter writing campaigns, but they have been writing letters, 250,000 letters in support of anti-IDC challengers in New York City. That is actually the one race that they haven't gotten involved in because there's not a single challenger, right? There are two other candidates on the ballot, and they said, look, we're not going to pick among Robert Jackson and these two other candidates, so we're going to steer clear of that race. So that's just one. There may be other groups that are supporting IDC challengers who are saying things are a little more complicated here because there are more candidates on the ballot.
Let's go to line two, Zach in Jackson Heights. Zach, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Good morning, Brian. Thanks for taking my call.
Who are you voting for?
The race I'm most interested in and I'm voting for is Jessica Ramos in Senate District 13 against Jose Peralta.
And that's another IDC-involved race. Peralta is the former IDC member who's the incumbent. Why are you choosing Ramos?
Well, originally, you know, my wife and I were dismayed after the election of Trump. And then a few months later, Peralta left to join the IDC and empower Republicans in Albany. So we were interested in anyone who would run against him. And over the last 9 months or so, we've gotten to know Jessica. And she's a nice balance of bread and butter issues like the MTA and public school funding, while at the same time talking about sort of the big progressive issues of abortion and ICE and those things. So she's really managed to balance, and to my money, a mixture of bread and butter day-to-day stuff with the big ideological beliefs as well.
Zach, thank you so much for chiming in. And Juan Manuel, this is one of the few races that Mayor de Blasio endorsed in. On the same side as our caller, we talked last hour about how he decided ultimately to abstain in the governor's race, the lieutenant governor's race, and the attorney general's race, even though his wife, Shirlane McCray, did make an endorsement for attorney general's effort to teach out. But de Blasio abstained, and he only made some endorsements in a few of these state Senate races, most of them IDC involved. And this is one of them where he went against the IDC candidate Peralta and did endorse Jessica Ramos. How do you see de Blasio's role in the anti-IDC movement?
That was an easy one for de Blasio, because Jessica Ramos, for those who don't know, she was a press aide to de Blasio till January. I think the mayor can help her out in that district. There's also a lot of ethnic politics in that district, and sometimes you ask politicians about ethnic political questions and they say, like, this is not about if I'm Dominican or but ethnic politics in the city are alive and well. So you have Jessica Ramos, who is a Colombian heritage. She could be the first Colombian American maybe in the state Senate. Senator Peralta is Dominican. This is a district that includes Jackson Heights, Corona, Willits Point, East Elmhurst. So it's a really interesting race, because Peralta drew the ire of many of his constituents last year, or a couple of years ago, when he decided to join the IDC. People were extremely upset. We had like a video of some community meetings, and people are booing at him because of his decision to join the IDC. Remember that this happened right after Trump, if I remember correctly, got into the White House. So a lot of people were really upset. How is it that I voted for a Democrat, you, Jose Peralta, and all of a sudden you're going to empower the Republicans in Albany? So this is going to be an extremely interesting race. I think it's going to be really close, because you also have all the newcomers in the district that see Jessica Ramos as someone like their own, young, energetic, progressive. And she's also aligned with Cynthia Nixon and, I believe, Zephyr Teachout.
And I'm not sure, but I'll take that alignment as you describe it. Also interesting to see that Senator Gillibrand jumped in on that side of that race, too. When we look at our two U.S. senators, Grace, Schumer just endorsed Cuomo and stayed out of everything else. I guess he's got other things on his mind, or I don't know what. But Gillibrand, who's really trying to raise her profile nationally as a progressive leader and possible 2020 Democratic presidential nominee, she did endorse Cuomo, not Cynthia Nixon, but Gillibrand endorsed four of these opponents to IDC members: Alessandra Biaggi against Jeff Klein, Jessica Ramos, who we've been talking about, against Jose Peralta, Zellner Myrie against IDC-involved Jesse Hamilton in Brooklyn, and also Robert Jackson in the race we were talking about before against Marisol Contura. So how do you see the Gillibrand factor?
So it's interesting. I think she here is trying to sort of thread the needle and have it all ways to a certain extent. And look, we haven't seen, frankly, many, if any, high-profile political figures, other than Melissa Mark Viverito, the former city council speaker, come out and back Cynthia Nixon. The newspapers haven't backed her. They've gone with Andrew Cuomo. Schumer's gone with Cuomo. Gillibrand with Cuomo. It's not surprising to me that she would go with him. She could make an argument, as could Schumer, that as a senator, they need to work with whoever wins this race, the gubernatorial primary, or the general election, obviously, in November. And so they want to stay out of it. But it's not surprising that she would back Cuomo. And this may be a way, by backing some of these IDC challengers, to signal to her base ahead of a potential presidential run that she's with the progressive wing of the party. She's going to rally with them, and she'll go out on a limb even for hyper-local races like these ones.
With Grace Rao, Zach Fink, and Juan Manuel Benitez from New York One, Brian Lehrer live in the green space for a primary day special. We'll continue in a minute. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, live in the green space today with a primary day election special, including our informal, unofficial, thoroughly unscientific exit poll. Listeners, who are you voting for today? For governor, for lieutenant governor, for state attorney general, and in the many contested state Senate primaries that could help to determine if Democrats or Republicans control the Senate next year. 212-433-WNYC, 433-96. 9-2. As we continue with our guests, Grace Rao, New York One City Hall reporter, Zach Fink, New York One Albany reporter. I'm supposed to say Spectrum News, New York One now, so I'll say it. And Juan Manuel Benitez, host of Puerto Politica on their Spanish language channel, Spectrum, New York One Noticias. And 212-433-WNYC listeners, if you want to get in. I want to mention that there are state Senate races other than the IDC involved ones, and maybe the most important, maybe even more important to ultimate control of the Senate than any of the IDC races, is the challenge to Democratic incumbent Simca Felder, who also supports Republican control separate from the IDC members, and from what I understand, intends to continue to do so. Control of the Senate may turn out to rest on this race alone. The challenger's name is Blake Morris. This is Midwood, Borough Park, Ditmas Park, around there. Hang on one second. Let me look at my screen. I think we have a Blake Morris caller, and I'll start with this if he's there. Yeah, line one, let's take that call. Stefan, in that district, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hey, Brian, thanks so much for taking my call. I appreciate it.
Talk about your decision.
So, you know, my district has been controlled by Simca Felder for the last 6 years, and he's got his first challenger. And Blake Morris is a true progressive. He is in support of funding the subway. He's supporting the New York Health Act. He wants smart gun control. He's even proposed a tri-borough RX new subway line to connect Brooklyn and Queens, finally, and he has proposed to do it in a cost-effective way. He was also endorsed by the New York Times, which I think has not gotten a lot of press. So, yeah, I'm full-throatedly endorsing Blake Morris. Felder is he's a Republican in disguise. He's, according to the New York Times article, he's actually going to be on the Republican, the conservative, and the independent ticket in November, regardless of what happens today. Hmm. So, you know, it feels like a no-brainer to me.
Stefan and Midwood, thank you very much. Zach, remind us of the background on Felder, this pro-Republican Democrat.
So Simca Felder is technically a Democrat, although he did get elected on the Republican line also in the last election, which I think is worth noting. But let me give you a great example of just how significant he is. You have a razor-thin majority by the Republicans in the state Senate, and Felder is the key swing vote. He's vote number 32, which is the magic number to govern. This past session, as things were wrapping up in Albany, there was this big issue about speed cameras and whether or not they would reauthorize speed cameras, and Felder was against this. There were certain things he wanted in exchange for it. Republicans, instead of listening to their city members, for example, Marty Golden in Brooklyn being a key example, who really needed that for his constituents. He's also in a tough race. They went with Felder. They value his swing vote so much that they were willing to go with him over their protecting their own member, Marty Golden. And Marty Golden could have a really serious race on his hands come November. But everyone is worried about upsetting Felder, and everybody placates to him. And he held the entire budget hostage in March over issues regarding yeshivas, which had nothing to do with the budget. And then this time around with speed cameras, and in both instances, he got his way.
And who is Blake Morris? Grace, any more background on him?
I actually don't have that much background on him. I think in part because he, frankly, Simca Felder is so popular in his district, and I think it's going to be a real long shot for Blake Morris to pull this off. And if he does manage to do it, he's still going to be facing Simcha Felder in November in a general election. And I believe New York One invited both candidates. We've been holding debates for all of these state Senate candidates. And my understanding is that we invited both of them to come on and debate, and that Blake Morris turned us down, which seemed very strange if you're running an insurgent candidate and you want as much press as you can get, which seemed sort of like a quizzical decision and made me wonder what this is all about, frankly.
Quizzical indeed. And the other soap opera non-IDC involved state Senate primary is between Martin Malave-Dilan and Julia Salazar. And this is the 18th District, parts of Greenpoint, Williamsburg, Bushwick, and around there near the Queens-Brooklyn line. Salazar, if you haven't been following the coverage of her, is the Democratic Socialist and Ocasio-Cortez endorsed candidate who seems to have made up a number of things about her biography that have gotten so much media buzz, like saying she's an immigrant when she was born in the U.S., saying she graduated from Columbia University when she finished her coursework but didn't graduate, saying she was raised working class when her family reportedly was more financially comfortable than that, and other things. And yet her policies are on the more progressive end than his. So how do you see this race today with all this crazy publicity, Juan Manuel?
This is a really interesting race, not only because she fabricated or was really vague with certain key aspects of her biography, but also because of the attention that the race has gotten and the money involved in the campaign and in digging up dirt on the insurgent candidate, in this case, the challenger, Julia Salazar. And I think it shows that we have a group of most of them young women who are challenging the establishment, right? Like we have Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, or we have someone like Jessica Ramos, or in other districts like Alessandra Biaggi. So they found this weakest link, this one that they could find some weaknesses, and they blew them up.
You mean her bio points?
Right. And they decided to say, I think it got so many attention because they saw her as someone to attack, and then by association, try to weaken the other female, young female progressive candidates. We'll see if that in the end happens, but she has a lot of support with the newcomers, with the young progressives in that district. Again, it's going to be energy versus loyalty. I don't know how much loyalty the constituents in that district have toward Martin Malave-Dilan, or the energy that she can pull with the newcomers that many of them are not even registered in the district.
We have a Salazar supporter calling in, Micah in Brooklyn. You're on WNYC. Hi there.
Hi there.
So tell us why you're voting for Salazar.
Yeah, so I'm going to vote for Salazar over Dylan. So I know that they both have their issues, but Dylan has taken over $320,000 from real estate companies over the past several years. He also has taken money from the SICC, which is a kind of campaign arm of the IDC. He's also taken money directly from Jeff Klein before. So, I mean, it's true that Salazar has troubled issues, to put it politely, with the truth with respect to her background. But I feel that Dylan has kind of already shown who he is, and who he is not aligned with the people of East New York or Cypress Hill. So
the interesting thing is here is Dylan so bad that you're going to vote for Salazar even though you acknowledge that there is some, she has some issues with the truth?
Yes.
Okay. No, that's totally fair.
Thank you very much. One reason Juan Manuel sometimes sits in this chair, he can have good interactions with the callers. I'm praising you. There's nothing to apologize for there. But, you know, and I guess this runs throughout politics. People who support your issues have whatever personal problems they may have. I mean, we can even talk about Trump in this regard, right? People know he's a liar and he's a con man and this and that, and many of his supporters vote for him anyway because he's right on immigration as they see it or some of these other things.
Right. I mean, we're all willing, many voters are willing to overlook plenty of problems within their own party, within their own preferred candidates, when it comes down to the issues they care about. Because bottom line, they don't necessarily need to spend time with these people or hang out with them. They want them to deliver certain votes in Albany. And so I think that that's more what this is about. And also it's about sort of a new generation of people entering politics. There's an age, significant age difference between these two candidates. She's a young woman, and there is a lot of energy that she's getting among young voters. And frankly, the calculus on the left, you might think that other progressives who had aligned themselves with her might distance themselves after all of these stories surfaced, but that hasn't really been the case. Cynthia Nixon has been campaigning with Julia Salazar last night at Nixon's Get Out the Vote rally. Salazar wasn't there on stage with her, but Nixon gave her a shout out from the stage. So she doesn't seem to think that it's bad politics on primary day for her to still be embracing a candidate with so many red flags.
And let me mention the new thing today in the news about Salazar. It's that she's one of 12 women who have accused Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's spokesman David Keyes of sexual assault or other inappropriate behavior. But Zach, she never went public with that. A right-wing website yesterday outed her as an alleged sexual assault victim, which, besides being outrageous, is to me politically head-scratching. I mean, on one level, it's victimizing her right there, victimizing her by stealing her privacy on something that happened to her, allegedly, that she did not choose to go public with. But does it also mean the right thinks being allegedly victimized by a Netanyahu aide would be bad for her politically?
I mean, the whole thing is, I mean, there's just one thing after another in that Salazar race. It's almost hard to keep up. I mean, obviously, if that happened, I don't know the details of that. I mean, that's horrible. And my understanding is she actually wanted to get ahead of being outed by the Daily Caller piece. So she went public with that information.
Only when she knew it was going to be published.
When she knew it was going to be public. And, you know, but you know, it's been very interesting because when all of this started to come out, we were, as political reporters, saying, well, we should really ask, you know, Zephyr Teachout and Cynthia Nixon if they're going to stand by her. And they really have. I mean, look, the bottom line is Martin Dillon has been there a long time. He was an ally of Vito Lopez. So I think that works into this. Also, Vito Lopez, who was found guilty by J-COPE, the Public Ethics Commission, of sexually harassing interns who worked for him. So I do
state
think—
State legislator and former leader of the Democratic Party in Brooklyn.
Was the head of exactly. Was the Democratic boss in Brooklyn, and he went down in spectacular fashion. And there were some really bitter feelings about that because many of the legislators, particularly in the Assembly, and Democrats, including Sheldon Silver, the former speaker, stood up for Vito Lopez and allowed, you know, kind of looked the other way as a lot of this went on. So I do think some of that plays into that as well. And, you know, the ghosts of Vito Lopez, if they haunt anybody, it's Marty Dillon.
Line 9, Diane in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello, Diane.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to make another statement about Simca Felder. My primary concern is for myself that I live in a rent-stabilized apartment, and the rent stabilization laws are coming up for renewal this session in 2019, and the Republicans have shot down any pro-tenant legislation that Democrats have proposed. And so I'm concerned. And Democrats have been proposing pro-tenant and pro-rent stabilization legislation.
So you're voting for Blake Morris over Simca Felder on that basis?
Yeah, because he tips the balance, and that is a critical issue for affordable housing in the city.
Diane, thank you very much for your call. And this even goes back to something that I saw, Grace, on New York One last night when Ocasio-Cortez was a guest of Vera Lewis, and in maintaining her support for Julia Salazar, she raised a number of issues that progressive state Senate candidates are running on, and one of them was universal rent control, mm-hmm. Which is a Cynthia Nixon position too, I think, and this is one that hasn't gotten as much press as a few of the others, like Medicare for All or Raise the Millionaire's Tax. Do you know what is universal rent control?
Well, so my understanding is that it is a dramatic expansion of rent control the rent control laws as we have it. And Cynthia Nixon's proposal also would claw back apartments that had been under rent control or rent regulation, but had basically passed out of it because rents had been raised to a certain level. I think it's $2,500 a month, then you're no longer in rent stabilization or rent control. And so her program would claw it back and then dramatically expand it, especially in upstate New York. I think it hasn't gotten a lot of attention because many people view it as highly unlikely, sort of like a pie in the sky proposal. I'm not saying that that's the case. I haven't looked at the numbers that deeply, but it is a key part of her platform and something that other progressive candidates have certainly been talking about. And as we know, affordable housing, especially in New York City, is such a huge, huge issue. And so it is something that right away is allowing some of these candidates to connect directly with voters because, you know, it's hard to find a New Yorker who's not struggling to pay their rent.
So Zach Fink, as the Albany correspondent in the room, let's assume for the moment that the Democrats do take control of the state Senate, either with Cuomo or with Nixon, presumably as the governor. What happens to the rent laws conversation?
I think now you could potentially see some action, but let's not forget, I mean, the original sin here was vacancy decontrol. That was in the 90s. That is basically so that as these apartments become vacant, you know, they go to the regular market. We have been losing rent stabilized and rent controlled apartments for 20 years, more so. And let's also remember, Democrats had control of the Senate briefly with Obama in 08. They won and they controlled it for about a year and a half before the coup and all this crazy stuff happened in Albany. And they didn't do anything about it. So, you know, I think the climate has changed. I give credit to the fact that if the Democrats were back in control, they would address this issue, hearing the public on this. But they didn't once already. And it just gives you a sense of how firm the real estate industry's grip is on both parties to a certain extent. So that's going to be that to me is the first thing as a progressive, you know, body should do is address that because that affects an awful lot of New Yorkers.
Line 4, Jenny in Westchester. You're on WNYC. Hi, Jenny.
Good morning. Yes, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to push back a little on a previous caller you had who was supporting Virginia Perez over Andrea Stewart Cousins. I got involved in Westchester politics last year, and I saw firsthand how Virginia Perez was in a little kind of like a mini IDC on the Westchester County Board of Legislators. She caucused with Republicans. So she's running a very cynical campaign now where she's sort of on the coattails of Ocasio-Cortez presenting herself as this young Latina change voter, and she's really not. Whereas Andrea Stewart Cousins has been a very solid progressive leader. She could be a majority leader in the state Senate if the Democrats take control. And also, I did see reporting that Virginia Perez has received financial contributions from Jeff Klein. So he's got his own ambitions, pretending to be all happy and united with the Democrats. But, you know, he clearly wants to be majority leader of the state Senate, too. So my support is solidly behind Andrea Stewart Cousins, and I think Virginia Perez.
Jenny,
Perez is going to lose, I hope.
Jenny, thank you very much. To line 4, Janine in Crown Heights. Janine, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hey, Brian, how are you? I wish
Good.
I could have been there today. I was going to vote for Zelma Myrie, but I moved to Crown Heights in March.
And that's one of those anti-IDC votes. Go ahead.
He wasn't even on the ballot where I voted. So I'm double-checking my district, but my name wasn't on the list, even though I received stuff from the Board of Elections. That said, I was in the right district, so I had to do an affidavit vote, and none of the Senate folks were listed on the affidavit vote. So there was the governor, there was the judge, and the attorney general. So that's something I just wanted to put out there, and if anyone, I'm going to go to the Board of Elections tomorrow and check it out. But if anyone has that situation, some of the state senators aren't even listed on the affidavit ballot.
That's the race where Zelma Myrie is the anti-IDC challenger against Jesse Hamilton, who is in the IDC. Can any of the three of you say for sure that Crown Heights is in that district.
I think part of Crown Heights, right? I'm not sure all of it.
And these districts are so funny sometimes, right. Yeah. The way they're drawn.
What block you're living in.
Yeah. So, and to the problem with the affidavit voting, have any of you heard before about some races being excluded from one version of a ballot that might be on another printed version?
I haven't heard that. I know two women that I follow on Twitter who are regular voters both tweeted that they went to the polls today and they were not on the rolls and they had to vote by affidavit ballots, but I didn't hear anything about candidates being missing from those ballots.
But I love the fact that your caller is so committed with voting that she's going to go to the Board of Elections tomorrow to talk about this.
Yes. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, live from the Green Space with our primary day special. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, live in the Green Space today with our primary day election special. And our guests from Spectrum News New York One, Grace Rao, their City Hall reporter, Zach Fink, Albany reporter, and Juan Manuel Benitez, host of Puerto Politica on their Spanish language channel, New York One Noticias. And as some of you know, Juan is sometimes guest host here. Let's take another question or comment here in the green space. Hi there.
Hi, my name's Sarah. I am going out this afternoon canvassing for Blake Morris and in Brooklyn, and I was out for Alessandra Biaggi two nights ago up in the Bronx. I've spent a lot of the summer working on a program that Grace mentioned, postcardstovoters.org, which is a national program that's been writing postcards for candidates, 107 now, all over the country. People all over the country can help. But I learned about the IDC shortly after the 2016 election, and I've been living here since 1980 and just have not spent a lot of time working on politics at all, but I was kind of, you know, just shocked by everything that I learned about it. And I think there's so many things that have been blocked by the fact that these people in Simca Felder have been controlling giving the control to the Republicans. And one such a basic thing, like, that I keep coming back to when I mention to people, is that we don't have early voting. We're number 43 in voting for the whole country on states. We're so behind, and that's because there are a lot of people that can't vote because we don't have early voting, and I just think, you know, how can we not have early voting? How can we, and we're not blue. I find out basically we're not a blue state.
And for all our talk about this primary election day and all our coverage of it leading up, in the New York primary in 2014, I guess the last time governor was up, only about 10%. I've seen 9%, I've seen 11%. So right around 10% was the turnout. 10%. That would mean, I guess, that 90% of people who were even so far along as to be registered Democrats in the first place did not turn out to vote. We'll see how much higher that is today and if turnout has any impact. I noticed that the New York Post, conservative paper, obviously made some endorsements on this Democratic primary day. They did not endorse for governor or lieutenant governor or attorney general, but they did endorse in some of these IDC-related races, in each case for the IDC candidate, for Jeff Klein, for Tony Avella in Queens over the challenger John Liu, for Diane Savino on Staten Island over the challenger Jasmine Robinson. They also, I guess they want to go against the self-described socialist, though they oppose Julia Salazar, even though that's not an IDC race, and endorse Martin DeLon. What's the Post's interest in having these Democrats who still say they're Democrats and are going to vote with the Democrats?
I have to think that the Post views those former IDC members as way, which they are, they're much more centrist than the challengers who are running in large part to their left. And so if they were reelected, if the state Senate becomes Democratic controlled, at least to the post mind, there would be more centrist Democrats at the table. And then there are people on the left who don't necessarily believe that the IDC is totally disbanded. And they point to things like the fundraising apparatus that Jeff Klein still is taking advantage of, to suggest that, look, a deal's a deal at the time, but who's to say it doesn't fly out the window? And if something very unexpected happens and you have something like Cynthia Nixon winning and becoming the next governor, you could see something like the IDC coming right back into existence and being supported by all sorts of interests across New York State who may be terrified by the idea of a, you know, very progressive government up in Albany.
I would be really surprised, with all due respect to the New York Post, if there are many Democrats out there that are going to take cues from the Post on who to vote today. But one thing that I want to say about endorsements, and now that we're talking about them, is that if you're going to be a media or a news institution that wants to have the moral authority to tell voters who to vote for, and you have a group of people making those decisions that are in some ways are extremely important because we're talking about them, because we keep repeating them, right? I think this city still has to do a better job at representing in those editorial boards the diversity of the city we are in. And this city is 28% Latino. There are some institutions with a lot of power, with a lot of moral authority, don't have a single Hispanic or Latino on their boards. People who can be on the ground and listen to some communities that are key in the electoral process and could bring some perspective before they make such a key decision in politics like today.
Let me turn to one breaking news issue relative to the primary. We now know the names of the people responsible for the lying Cuomo mailer that they now regret falsely smearing Nixon with being anti-Semitic. The Times and the Post both, I believe, obtained emails showing it was written by a former Cuomo aide named David Lobel, if I'm saying that right, and approved by Cuomo's former very top deputy, Larry Schwartz. Schwartz claimed he inadvertently didn't read the objectionable parts before he approved the language. Zach Fink, what's New York One reporting on this?
Well, we do know, from what I understand, that as far back as this spring, Cuomo made a kind of off-color joke about Jews not having rhythm, and it really didn't go over very well. And apparently, from what I understand at that time, David Lobel was asked by people within Cuomo's orbit to kind of look into how they can wedge Cynthia Nixon on that issue. And David Lobel and a couple of other individuals did some research, and they came up with the basis for that mailer, but also determined that that stuff was largely not true. Well, fast forward to August, maybe Cuomo's internals are a little bit tighter than they want us to believe. Suddenly, that mailer got resurrected. I did speak to David Lobel. He did, in fact, you know, write the bullet points that became the basis for that mailer that went out. He told me that Larry Schwartz was the one who approved it. However, he also says he doesn't know who else they showed it to. So it could have gone to more eyeballs as well. I mean, the whole thing is very, very ugly. I think it more speaks to, in general, because I think David Lobel's not necessarily a household name. He did kind of constituent services for the governor, outreach specifically to the Jewish community, Cuomo's trips to Israel. He was the one who arranged them, worked in the executive chamber up until about June, and now he works for a lobbyist. But, you know, he's not a player who people are intimately familiar with. But the manner in which this was handled in general by the Cuomo administration, I think, was clumsy to the point where people almost thought, you know, negligence. I mean, this really surfaced over the weekend. Had they immediately said someone from within the party was responsible and they're going to resign for it, I think the story would have died, frankly, a lot more quickly. But it stayed alive up until today. I mean, we're still talking about it, and it's right. Actual primary day.
Right, like 6 days later, yeah.
And the explanation that they've given is laughable. I mean, literally everyone in this room started laughing because the idea that Larry Schwartz didn't look at the objectionable part of the flyer or flip it over is absurd, frankly. So that's also why there had been so much interest in the story, in part because the governor's explanation of how this mailer came to exist also didn't pass the laugh test or the smell test, right? I mean, when he said, "I knew nothing about this," anyone who covers Governor Cuomo knows that he is intimately involved in any kind of campaign messaging around this race. And it's hard to imagine any scenario in which he would have not known directly or indirectly about what was being put in that mailer.
Listeners, a quick reminder that I will be back at 9 o'clock tonight to host New York State Primary Returns. That'll be on WNYC, AM and FM, and WNYC.org. We hope to be over at 10 o'clock tonight, but we'll see. But anyway, that's 9 o'clock for election returns coverage here on WNYC. Join me for that. And we thank three of Spectrum News New York One's best, Grace Rao, Zach Fink, and Juan Manuel Benitez, who also now host a podcast together called Off Topic on Politics. I know you guys are going to be on the air like every 10 minutes today, so thank you so much for giving us some of your morning.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Brian.
And thanks to all of you who came to the green space today. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.
WNYC supporters include the New York Botanical Garden, featuring Georgia O'Keeffe, Visions of Hawaii, Rare Works reunited in New York for the first time since 1940, and the plants and flowers that inspired them, through October 28th, nybg.org. John Thurer Cancer Center at Hackensack University Medical Center, part of the Memorial Sloan Kettering Hackensack Meridian Health Partnership. John Thurer Cancer Center is pioneering the possible. More at jtcancercenter.org.
As Hurricane Florence barrels down on the Carolinas, the takeaway looks at emergency preparedness, especially for the most vulnerable among us, from low-wage workers to the chronically ill and others. Join Tanzina Vega today at 3 o'clock on WNYC.
This is WNYC, FM, HD, and AM New York.